Chapter 7. Fruit shops and fish stalls, the dresses and chatter of all nations, the soldiers in scarlet, and women in black mantillas, the beggars, boatmen, barrels of pickled herrings and macaroni, the shovel-hatted priests and bearded capuchins, the tobacco, grapes, onions, and sunshine, the signboards, bottled porter stores, the statues of saints and little chapels which jostle the stranger's eyes as he goes up the famous stairs from the water gate, make a scene of such pleasant confusion and liveliness as I have never witnessed before. And the effect of the groups of multitudinous actors in this busy cheerful drama is heightened, as it were, by the decorations of the stage. The sky is delightfully brilliant, all the houses and ornaments are stately, castle and palaces are rising all around, and the flag, towers, and walls of Fort St. Elmo look as fresh and magnificent as if they had been erected only yesterday. The Strada Reale has a much more courtly appearance than that one described. Here are palaces, churches, courthouses and libraries, the genteel London shops, and the latest articles of perfumery. Gay young officers are strolling about in shell jackets much too small for them. Midshipmen are clattering by on hired horses. Squads of priests, habited after the fashion of Don Basilio in the opera, are demurely pacing to and fro. Professional beggars run shrieking after the stranger. And agents for horses, for inns, and for worse places still, follow him and insinuate the excellence of their goods. The houses where they are selling carpetbacks and pomatum were the palaces of the successors of the goodliest company of gallant knights the world ever heard tell of. It seems unromantic, but these were not the romantic knights of St. John. The heroic days of the order ended as the last Turkish galley lifted anchor after the memorable siege. The present stately houses were built in times of peace and splendor and decay. I doubt whether the Auberge de Provence, where the Nyon Club flourishes now, has ever seen anything more romantic than the pleasant balls held in the great room there. The Church of St. John, not a handsome structure without, is magnificent within. A noble hall covered with a rich embroidery of gilded carving, the chapels of the different nations on either side, but not interfering with the main structure, of which the whole is simple, and the details only splendid. It seemed to me a fitting place for this wealthy body of aristocratic soldiers, who made their devotions as it were on parade, and, though on their knees, never forgot their epaulets or their quarters of nobility. This mixture of religion and worldly pride seems incongruous at first. But have we not a church at home similar relics of feudal ceremony? The verger with the silver mace who precedes the vicar to the desk, the two chaplains of my lord archbishop, who bow over his grace as he enters the communion table gate, even poor John, who follows my lady with a coroneted prayer book, and makes his conge as he hands it into the pew. What a chivalrous absurdity is the banner of some high and mighty prince, hanging over his stall in Windsor Chapel, when you think of the purpose for which men are supposed to assemble there. The Church of the Knights of St. John is paved over with sprawling heraldic devices of the dead gentlemen of the dead order, as if, in the next world, they expected to take rank in conformity with their pedigrees, and would be marshalled into heaven according to the orders of precedence. Cumbrous handsome paintings adorn the walls and chapels, decorated with pompous monuments of grand masters. Beneath is a crypt, where more of these honorable and reverend warriors lie, in a state that a Simpson would admire. In the altar are said to lie three of the most gallant relics in the world, the keys of Acre, Rhodes, and Jerusalem. What blood was shed in defending these emblems! What faith, endurance, genius, and generosity! What pride, hatred, ambition, and savage lust of blood were roused together for their guardianship! In the lofty halls and corridors of the governor's house, some portraits of the late Grand Master still remain. A very fine one, by Caravaggio, of a knight in gilt armor, hangs in the dining room, near a full length of poor Louis XVI. In royal robes, the very picture of uneasy impotency. But the portrait of the Vignacourt is the only one which has a respectable air. The other chiefs of the famous society are pompous old gentlemen in black, with huge periwigs, and crowns round their hats, and a couple of melancholy pages in yellow and red. But pages and wigs and grandmasters have almost faded out of the canvas, and are vanishing into Hades with a most melancholy indistinctness. The names of most of these gentlemen, however, live as yet in the forts of the place, which all seem to have been eager to build and christen. So that it seems as if, in the Malta mythology, they had been turned into freestone. In the armory is the very suit painted by Caravaggio, by the side of the armor of the noble old La Valette, whose heroism saved his island from the efforts of Mustafa and Dragut, and an army quite as fierce and numerous as that which was baffled before Gibraltar, by similar courage and resolution. The sword of the last-named famous corsair, a most truculent little scimitar, thousands of pikes and halberds, little old cannons and wall pieces, helmets and cuirasses, which the knights or their people wore, are trimly arranged against the wall, and, instead of spiking Turks or arming warriors, now serve to point morals and adorn tails. And here likewise are kept many thousand muskets, swords, and boarding pikes for daily use, and a couple of ragged old standards of one of the English regiments, who pursued and conquered in Egypt the remains of the haughty and famous French Republican army, at whose appearance the last knights of Malta flung open the gates of all their fortresses, and consented to be extinguished without so much as a remonstrance, or a kick, or a struggle. We took a drive into what may be called the country, where the fields are rocks, and the hedges are stones, passing by the stone gardens of the Florian, and wondering at the number and handsomeness of the stone villages, and churches rising everywhere among the stony hills. Handsome villas were passed everywhere, and we drove for a long distance along the sides of an aqueduct, quite a royal work of the Caravaggio in gold armor, the Grandmaster de Vignacourt. A most agreeable contrast to the arid rocks of the general scenery was the garden at the governor's country house, with the orange trees and water, its beautiful golden grapes, luxuriant flowers, and thick cool shrubberies. The eye longs for this sort of refreshment, after being seared with the hot glare of the general country, and St. Antonio was as pleasant after Malta as Malta was after the sea. We paid the island a subsequent visit in November, passing 17 days at an establishment called Fort Manuel there, and by Punster's the Manuel de Voyageurs, where government accommodates you with quarters, where the authorities are so attentive as to send your letters with aromatic vinegar before you receive them, and so careful of your health as to lock you up in your room every night lest you should walk in your sleep, and so over the battlements into the sea, if you escaped drowning in the sea, the sentries on the opposite shore would fire at you, hence the nature of the precaution. To drop, however, this satirical strain, those who know what quarantine is, may fancy that the place somehow becomes unbearable in which it has been endured. And though the November climate of Malta is like the most delicious May in England, and though there is every gaiety and amusement in the town, a comfortable little opera, a good old library filled full of good old books, none of your works of modern science, travel, and history, but good old useless books of the last two centuries, and nobody to trouble you in reading them, and though the society of Valletta is most hospitable, varied, and agreeable, yet somehow one did not feel safe in the island, with perpetual glimpses of Fort Manuel from the opposite shore, and, lest the quarantine authorities should have a fancy to fetch one back again, on the pretext of posthumous plague, we made our way to Naples by the very first opportunity those who remained, that is, of the little eastern expedition. They were not all there. The giver of life and death had removed two of our company. One was left behind to die in Egypt, with a mother to bewail his loss, another we buried in the dismal Lazaretto cemetery. Asterisk, 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 one is bound to look at this too, as a part of our journey. Disease and death are knocking perhaps at your next cabin door. Your kind and cheery companion has ridden his last ride and emptied his last glass beside you. And while fond hearts are yearning for him far away, and his own mind, if conscious, is turning eagerly towards the spot of the world, whither affection or interest calls it, the great father summons the anxious spirit from earth to himself, and ordains that the nearest and dearest shall meet here no more. Such an occurrence as a death in a lazaretto, mere selfishness renders striking. We were walking with him, but 2 days ago on deck. One has a sketch of him, another his card, with the address written yesterday, and given with an invitation to come and see him at home in the country, where his children are looking for him. He is dead in a day, and buried in the walls of the prison. A doctor felt his pulse by deputy. A clergyman comes from the town to read the last service over him, and the friends who attend his funeral are marshaled by lazaretto guardians, so as not to touch each other. Every man goes back to his room and applies the lesson to himself. One would not so depart without seeing again the dear, dear faces. We reckon up those we love. They are but very few, but I think one loves them better than ever now. Should it be your turn next? And why not? Is it pity or comfort to think of that affection which watches and survives you? The Maker has linked together the whole race of man with this chain of love. I like to think that there is no man but has had kindly feelings for some other, and he for his neighbor, until we bind together the whole family of Adam. Nor does it end here. It joins heaven and earth together. For my friend or my child of past days is still my friend, or my child to me here, or in the home prepared for us by the Father of all. If identity survives the grave, as our faith tells us, is it not a consolation to think that there may be one or two souls among the purified and just, whose affection watches us invisible, and follows the poor sinner on earth? Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.